Good afternoon, welcome to Know Yourself. This is Dan Udell and I'm here with Sarah Rees. Sarah is a CBT therapist and also the creator of the CBT Journal, which we'll talk a little bit more about on the show. Sarah, thanks for joining me.
Hi Dan, nice to see you.
Yeah, it's great having you on the show. We were talking a little bit beforehand and I was saying I'm really excited because we've never had a CBT therapist on the show before. And I think you're going to bring a lot to the table and, yeah, just looking forward to the conversation, really.
I hope so, yeah, looking forward to it.
You're based in Manchester, aren't you?
I am, yeah, South Manchester, yeah. Where are you based on?
So I'm in Worcestershire.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah. So the important question is, are you a Man United fan or a Man City fan?
God, no, I'm neither. That's dreadful, isn't it? But at least that's neutral. Get rid of half your audience. Yeah, not a footballer.
No, I don't actually watch the football myself. I actually watch American football. So, yeah, what we usually do at the start of the show, we were chatting a little bit beforehand. We used to do you sort of chapter one if you were writing a book about yourself or your origin story as to how you got to being a CBT therapist now. So tell us a little bit about yourself and your life to give some context for the audience and yeah, just hear your story really.
Okay, so I was brought up in my younger years in North Wales, a place called Colwyn Bay. Mum and dad and a little brother called Michael, who's 4 years younger than me. And I suppose kind of, going way back, isn't it, Liz? But
yeah.
The most kind of significant thing happened was we moved to Manchester when I was about 11. Moved to Manchester with a Welsh accent, went down like a lead balloon, as you can imagine. But shortly after that, my dad was killed in a car accident.
Oh,
and really kind of disrupted kind of the course of childhood and how things go. And I think, you know, I mean, I've heard you talk in your podcast about that most therapists have got kind of significant stuff in their life. And that was kind of my thing, really. I suppose you get quite used to, you know, you experience your own distress and that kind of makes you curious about other people's distress and things. So after that, life wasn't quite the same again. And I ended up leaving home when I was about 18. And got my first job in social care. And I worked for the local council and was part, I don't remember, if care in the community and rehoming people from the old asylums into community small houses.
Oh, right.
And that was kind of the first kind of job working with people with learning disabilities and mental health. And just got a real fascination of working with people with mental health problems from that. That really kind of drove my interest, I suppose, as well as my own experiences. And I thought at the time I really enjoyed it, but I thought, where do I go next? I knew that kind of care work in that capacity wasn't kind of a long-term thing I was going to do. And because I'd left home, so I was supporting myself, I looked at all my options and I couldn't afford to put myself through university. So I did the nursing course, which if I did, because it's now turned into a degree course, I just feel it's a real shame. It's all been a lot more academic now. I wouldn't have been able to do it, which is, you know, but at the time to train to be a nurse, you got a bursary.
Right.
So I could afford to do the training. I think it's gone now as well, which is a real shame. Because it's such a vocation. And I trained as a mental health nurse in Manchester. And I worked on lots of the wards and in the Manchester area, really enjoyed the training. I'm not naturally academic at all, so I've always kind of had to work very hard at that side of things, but absolutely loved the work with the patients. And my last placement was in a regional secure unit, a place called Presswich in Manchester. So, and that I found that really fascinating. And I thought I would go into forensic psychiatry at the time. But I looked at all my options, and when I qualified, I ended up going to a psychiatric intensive care unit at the Manchester Royal Infirmary.
Wow.
And from that, and that was absolutely, you know, really amazing, really good experience. I worked on most of the wards in the Manchester area, and then I became a community psychiatric nurse. And I absolutely loved that, really, really enjoyed it. But over time, I think with cuts and changes, the job really, really changed. And so I did a few things after that. I went to an early intervention team for working with teenagers with early onset psychosis, and then a crisis team. And then I was kind of, I really wanted to kind of make more of an impact in the NHS. And, you know, I was... did a lot of moaning and things, and I went into a managerial role. I ran the South Manchester primary care mental health team for a time, and really hated it. I am not a manager at all. So, you know, I missed being part of a team, and I worked long hours, and just realised, I used to go to all these important meetings and realise how much it was kind of about money, and it just wasn't about people, and I really found that totally frustrating. So, and it was around that time that the government were doing this new incentive to kind of get people trained up as therapists. I'd a couple of years before done a degree in psychosocial interventions, which covered a lot of different therapeutic approaches. And first, I'd, you know, main therapeutic approach was medication, and in psychiatric medication, while it, you know, I'm kind of absolutely for medication, you kind of see some of the huge side effects that medication have for people in terms of diabetes and weight gain. And, you know, it's just kind of, you, it's horrific, really, what people have to endure. And so you kind of, I got kind of a lot more focused on recovery, what other options are out there. And CBT was kind of becoming kind of a gold standard in kind of psychotherapy.
Yeah.
In terms of the recovery model. And I think I've always kind of, you know, I've worked in loads of different jobs and kind of got to the point where I got frustrated with it and thought, this isn't the answer, and then kind of got bored and moved on. And CBT, I thought, once I know CBT, I'll have it all in the bag and everybody else will get better. It's not the case at all. But I took quite a pay drop and demotion and left my managerial job and went and trained as a CBT therapist in Salford Cognitive Therapy Centre, which was just brilliant teaching, loved the course, but they put us through hell. It was a real, like, three-year course in 18 months.
Wow.
It was so hard. We had eight clients we saw a week. Everything was videoed. And then we'd have to sit in kind of group supervision with a teacher and some peers, and they'd analyse your sessions and go, why did you say that when, you know, you missed that? It was just really excruciating, really tough. But the learning curve was just absolutely amazing. Learned so much, but it was a really tough kind of 18 months. And when I finished that training, I was working in the primary care team where I'd been a manager, but just as a CBT therapist, and in full time. And it was a really deprived area, and the people that I could see, I could only see that, I think it was 12 sessions at the time I could see them for, and then it reduced to 8. I think it's about 6 or 8 now.
Gosh.
I know. And these were people that, you know, sometimes couldn't put food on the table, or it's like really extensive, long histories of abuse and trauma. And you just see them. And I started to feel a bit cruel that I was kind of lifting the box on stuff for people, only to say, and I had to, at the first session, I had to say, if you don't turn up, you'll miss the session. If you don't, you'll get discharged. All these really kind of tough rules that I had to put in place. These people were really, really struggling. They were really distressed, and were, you know, getting to a session was tough, and the, you know, maintain, it was just didn't sit with me, really.
Mm.
Although, you know, I think that was a few years ago now. I do hope things have improved. I'm not sure waiting times have improved drastically. But it was a great experience. And during that time, I also trained as an EMDR therapist, because that was a treatment that came into the NICE guidelines for the treatment of trauma. So the NICE guidelines are kind of guidelines which kind of recommend certain different treatment approaches for different conditions. So for post-traumatic stress, CBT and EMDR. And that's, I think I paid for that training myself. I think the NHS now do train up, they've trained up an awful lot of people. And that's mainly what I did then for quite some time in the NHS, because there's so many trauma cases out there and people needing this kind of treatment. And that was really phenomenal, you know, because of the speed in which people can get better and their symptoms reduce. So that was really, but I still had this kind of issue where people, you know, didn't have that many sessions, and the training, there was different training that I wanted to go on, different routes I wanted to take, and the NHS is so underfunded, they just can't fund those things and couldn't give me the time. So I'd always kind of been interested in private practice and doing something myself. So I started doing a small clinic in Wilmslow in Cheshire,
yeah,
and started building up a private practice, and did both for a while, and that was quite stressful because you end up feeling like you're doing neither very well. And I think my heart was just in private practice, but I was like, oh my god, my pension, sick pay, annual leave. But then I just thought, oh my god, you know, I just got to give it a go, and I can always get another job. You know, I've always kept my nursing registration because I always think, oh, I could always end up back on the wards and do that if it all goes to pop.
Yeah.
So I keep that. I need to let it go really at some point, but I think once you've trained as a nurse, you kind of hold on to it. So it was a really tough decision for me to leave the NHS, because, you know, when you become a nurse, you think, oh, I'm going to be a nurse for the rest of my life and, you know, be in the NHS forever. So it was a real kind of, I was really, really sad to leave. But then I think once I got my head round, well, I can always go back. I made the jump and went into private practice. And I think also being able to work with people for, you know, I thought that people would come to me for 6 to 12 sessions and then they'd go away. And what I found is that some people would come and just have 4 sessions and that was enough. But some people I've seen since I started, so 4 or 5 years, you know, some people use it as kind of the same way you would do physiotherapy or, you know, kind of maintenance for your kind of mind. So I was really, really interested in this, you know, kind of way people were using therapy in such a different way. I felt that they were much more empowered in the treatment process. And, you know, what we know in therapy is that so many people don't ever tell their deepest secrets in therapy. They kind of really hold on to them. But when you see people for longer, you know, for over 20 sessions, you kind of see people settle into therapy and there's a new level of trust and reflection and stuff. And that was just, I felt like I was really expanding my skills. So that was really good. So I absolutely love private practice, love the kind of flexibility of it. And then kind of I am absolutely inundated and really have been all the time, which has been fantastic, because I was like, oh, what if I don't get any referrals, and had all these panics and you don't know how things are going to be from 1 month to another. And I still touch wood and think I could end up on working as a nurse on the wards again. But I'm inundated, and that there's a part of me that's really saddened by that, because there's so many people that are becoming aware of mental health issues and wanting to just live a really fulfilled life, and know that part of that is cultivating their best self and understanding the patterns of their minds, and that their minds are as important as their bodies, and they're actually very, very much connected.
Yeah.
And wanting support and treatment, and it just isn't available. And that has kind of led me to start to think, right, how can I do something? I don't actually know what it's going to look like, but to kind of, there's lots of things that I know, especially in CBT, lots of strategies and techniques that people can be doing outside of the therapy room. And that's kind of led me to develop the CBT journal, which is to help educate people around the basics of CBT, what it is, and then create some awareness of the patterns of their mind. And I think I was really interested. I think it was it Laura that was on your podcast a couple of episodes back, and she was and you were saying to her, gosh, you've not had any therapy and you're so insightful, and she was saying it's journaling.
Yeah, she, like, some of the stuff she was talking about, I was like, it took me years of therapy to figure that stuff out.
I know, and I think journaling is another vent. It can be as useful as talking. And some people, you know, I had therapy a few years ago just before I was training to be a CBT therapist. It's the only therapy model where you don't have to have your own therapy. You can get away with it.
What?
I know, crazy. So when I started been trained in compassion-focused stuff, I was like, oh my God, I really need to go and get my own therapy. And then to turn up, it took me ages to find a therapist because I was so picky. I literally ruled out every therapist in the area because, like, they're not qualified enough and they're not experienced and they won't get me. So I was such a special case. And then, but how nervous I was, and I do it for a living, going to my first session, I thought, how the hell am I in a job? And I think journaling is sometimes a way to kind of ease you towards getting a bit more self-reflective and kind of a, you know, maybe for some people a step in between.
Yeah.
Kind of going to therapy. But I think it can be just really helpful. And I know that from the work I do with clients, the people that do the journaling, we know that in CBT, it's kind of, you spend an hour with a therapist, but it's really what you do in between sessions. It's that reflecting.
Yes.
And because therapy can be so tough, there can be, and I definitely experienced this, and I have my own therapy, that you want to leave the room and completely leave it there. And that's avoidance. And one of the ways to get better is to kind of turn towards your own difficulty. And it's about kind of letting your session land, reflecting on it, where you're going to get the most learning out of your therapy. So journaling in between sessions is hugely powerful. And you see that as a therapist, the people that do that kind of reflective work and just get so much more out of their treatment sessions. It's kind of two ways to kind of work with journaling. So
it's interesting because I hate journaling, but like, the thing is, I find it so beneficial but that I can't help but do it, because I know that the only reason I hate it is because it's making me face the things I don't want to think about.
It's horrible, isn't it? Yeah. So is that why you don't like it? Because of that turning towards what you want to avoid?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's, you know, it's, I remember I didn't start journaling until my training started, because when I went on my very first course, they said to me, you know, every week you're going to write a journal and you're going to bring it in to class and you're going to give it to me and I'm going to read your journal.
Oh my God.
And I was like, fuck. So, yeah. Like, she didn't read it out loud to the class, but she'd take it home and mark it.
Oh God.
And you'd be like, right. So suddenly you're like, I've got to write this journal, but like, I can't write it as if someone else is going to read it, because then it won't be authentic.
Yeah.
So you'd write this journal and you'd end up writing something really honest and like sort of brutally reflective almost. Mm. And you'd hand it in. And if it was something where you'd shown a lot of self-awareness or a lot of like humility or, you know, just, you know, some of those characteristics and traits, you know, you'd get marked well on it. And it didn't necessarily count towards anything other than the overall grade. It was like a small percentage of the grade. But like, doing that every week I'd dread it and I'd leave it until the day before or a couple of days before. But I'd always feel better after doing it. I'd always feel better after doing it and know what I needed to do next. And I started to find that even when I wasn't on the course, I was doing journals. And then during my second course, this was interesting, because on my second course, doing journals wasn't mandatory, but I did a journal every single week.
Wow.
Because for me, it was just really important in processing everything that was going on.
Yeah.
And it works.
What do you think you got from journaling?
I think that's self-awareness, really. Just knowing myself a little bit more. And also, it leads onto natural sort of reflection, I feel, as well. It's like it gets the ball rolling. And then as the next couple of days roll on, especially if you're going into therapy, I find that it really helps get the sort of the juices flowing, as it were.
Yes.
So between sessions, I end up thinking a lot more. And what happens is, if I'm having a really, really bad day, I'll write out a journal, because it just lifts that fog a little bit. And I describe it as like, it releases like mental bandwidth, so I can actually think about other stuff again.
Yes, it gives you a clarity over things. And we know that if, you know, we don't cope very well, if we're holding things in, it actually creates stress in the body and cortisol levels rise. And if you release that through talking or through writing, your stress levels come down. When our stress levels come down, it when you're too stressed or overwhelmed, it affects your prefrontal cortex, so you don't think that logically. So when you vent, you are calming down your physiology and getting more logical. So also, when there's you get more objective over your kind of experiences and your stories, because instead of, there's something very strange that happens when we are just in our own heads thinking stuff. It's like in the middle of the night, you know, when you wake up, you think, oh, I just have to think about something, and you can spend an hour thinking, and then the next day you're going, what was I going on about?
Yeah.
When we release it, and I get this in the therapy room all the time, that people will be talking to me and I'll kind of, you know, pick around a little bit and dig a bit deeper, and they go, my God, as I'm saying this, they're coming with new connections, being more objective, seeing things differently. And the same experience is in journaling as well. It's kind of like having access to a therapist 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
It's so powerful.
I've actually got my journal sat right next to me now. And if I go and look back to the first entry that I started, this was it was on the 25th of the 6th, because I went out and got myself a fancy journal from Paper Chase.
Very nice.
Because I think, like, you know, because it's a journal and it's like personal to you and it's going to have some of my deepest stuff in there, I thought I might as well spend a bit of money and get something I like.
Well, you're investing in you, isn't it? And I think that says a lot about how you're kind of looking after yourself and how you're investing in you and the quality of what you're doing. You know, if you bought yourself a cheap, scrappy notebook, you wouldn't value it in the same way. It's nice. I think it's a nice thing.
So this is from the entry that I wrote. It's actually called Happy Birthday Journal, because it's the first day I got it.
Oh, that's nice.
So, like, it's really interesting, because I've not looked back at this since I wrote it. I usually don't go back and read them. So this is interesting. The first paragraph literally says, I've been thinking a lot recently. I love the space that I'm in at the moment. My self-awareness has taken a giant priority, and I'm focusing on other traits such as humility and patience, as I believe that these are important to have and adore. What else does it say? I'm taking time for the podcast, but I'm doing one post a week because I don't want to burn myself out like I've done before.
How does it feel reading that back?
It's just really interesting. It's just like, it's just, it feels like a long time ago, but it feels like now I'm reading it, it's put me back to that like place I was in.
Yeah. And you can see your journey, can't you?
Yeah.
You know, how far you've come, what you've learned, that we kind of, if we're overwhelmed or if we're in certain states, it feels a bit fixed, but actually we're on a journey. And I think journaling gives you that sense of movement.
Do you write a journal?
I do. I started it. This all came about because when I hit 40, I was going to be fabulously thin and amazing, and I just got fat. Drinking loads of green juice, you know, when you used to juice them, apples, spinach, and all this stuff. And I was getting fatter and fatter. And because of the work I do, I do work with some people with eating disorders or digestive problems because of how stress affects us physically. So I worked with a nutritionist and I went to see her and said, I'm on this massive diet. I've got 4 weeks. I was going on a really holiday of a lifetime and everything. I was just getting fatter and fatter. And she put me on a bit of a diet. I did it, and I'm crap at diets, and I got fatter. And she said, oh, you need to go to your doctors and see what's going on. I went to my doctors and got diagnosed with an underactive thyroid. I was in private practice, and I got no time to be ill. And they put you, what they do is they just put you on thyroxine and go, there you go. So you've got this medication now, you're going to feel wonderful and everything will be back to normal. And I got really ill. I got chronic fatigue syndrome. My moods were all over the place. The thyroid is a gland in your throat, and it affects every system in your body, your metabolism, your mood. It's like everything is lower and suppressed. Oh, it's just awful. And I got chronic fatigue syndrome and was just getting iller and iller. And I was like going to my doctors and they were like, oh no, your bloods are fine. And everything, I got involved in all these forums online of people that, mainly in America, that couldn't even afford the medication, and like, just, it was really, really tough. And I ended up, and I went through a horrifically low period. And then my partner said, you're all over the place, you're a complete nightmare. Maybe need to start kind of journaling about it to see my symptoms. That's why I started it. And it was through kind of, so I did journaling, and my moods were up and down. I was struggling with anxiety, and you know, it was just a shit time. And you know, and this chronic fatigue. I remember walking up the stairs sometimes and I'd just be in tears because walking the stairs was so hard. And anyway, and so I started journaling about symptoms and how I was feeling, and at that point I started taking responsibility for my own health. Instead of, I'd kind of thought, I go to the doctor and they fix it, as you do. And that was really a challenge for me, because I was like, yeah, we fix it with this one plaster we have for everybody, but we're all completely unique and individual, and that one plaster doesn't fix it for most of us. And it just completely threw me. It was really scary, actually. And so it was through, at the point I started journaling was the point I started to take control. Actually, I need to do something about that. And when I started journaling, I could see patterns. I was looking at my sleep, my moods, my diet, how I was feeling. And then I went back to nutritionist, and you're not meant to like do juicing kale and spinach. It all affects your thyroid. And I was drinking gallons.
Oh, God.
And it was like basic nutritional information. I was doing everything you shouldn't be, because you don't know. The nutrition was so complicated. I started having reflexology, massages. I hate the gym. I've got dogs, and I think, well, that's good enough. That's good exercise. I had to go start the gym, got a personal trainer. I hated it. I like it now, and I go to the gym, but I start changing. And then it was kind of journaling through that, even though, you know, you're meant to, even for mental health stuff, you're meant to kind of get enough sleep, not drink alcohol, and do all this stuff, and it's all really boring. But when you journal about it, and you can really see the impact of, when I do that, this is the result. I could really see that. And once you get that kind of evidence, it's dead easy to do in the good stuff. So then I thought, God, this has been the key for me getting better. And it, exactly the same applies, and it, you know, it did help me with my mental health. It applies for everybody. With when we have mental health problems, there's loads of shame and stuff, so it takes longer to get to the GP. But we go and we get given an antidepressant and it doesn't work for everybody and it won't. If you take an antidepressant and hide under the duvet, you're not going to get better quickly. It's really about having a holistic approach, understanding the uniqueness of you and kind of working with that. So that was a very long answer.
Not at all. I think it's really important to talk about that story, one of the most difficult things that someone can go through, I think. I guess the irony of it didn't escape you either, you know, the fact that it's something that you probably suggested for your own clients and then you were having to do it yourself.
You know, I'm full of all these good ideas. I say this to clients all the time that, you know, I sit here spouting this shit all day long and then I go home, have a glass of wine. You know, it's really hard to care for yourself or do the things that you need sometimes. It took somebody else to tell me. It was my partner that was like, you need to sort yourself out. And I don't know, I think because we're programmed to want the quick fixes and want to comfort ourselves in certain ways that aren't always the ones that are best for us. You know, it's really hard to self-care sometimes, even when we know it. Well, you know, we've got all the information.
Because, something that you said, really struck me about, taking a pill and going under the duvet. It can seem a bit unfair, sometimes I remember thinking to myself, I just don't understand, I don't understand why everyone else is walking around and they look like they're doing okay, and, there seems like a certain sense of it not being fair, but, I've come to realise, especially over the past year or so, that it isn't fair, but it never really was. My perspective on life in general has really sort of shifted, in the last year, to sort of realising how lucky that we actually are anyway.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that you're living in this country, you can walk up to a tap and you can turn it on and fresh water comes out that you can drink.
Yeah.
And you only had to walk steps to get it. Mm. And it's really interesting. Yeah. There's a quote from a Rocky film. And it says, I've got it here. It says, let me tell you something you already know. The world ain't all sunshines and rainbows. It's a very mean and nasty place. And it'll beat you to your knees and keep you there permanently if you let it. You, me, or nobody's going to hit as hard as life. But it ain't how hard you get hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward.
Yeah. It's a building resilience.
Yeah. And...
And I think one thing of being a therapist has really taught me is that, you know, I get just amazing people walk through my door every single day. And, you know, we look around and think that everybody else has got it together and doing okay, but it's a social mask. We all struggle. We're all struggling at different times in our lives, different points. But, you know, we all have a story to tell. We just don't know everybody's story.
That's right. And it's weird because it's always nice after something's happened to, you've got that sort of hindsight 20/20 vision, but I genuinely look back and the different things that have happened and I kind of think I'm glad, because it doesn't really matter what happens. A lot of the time I just think I've been worse, things have been so much worse. And I've gotten through that, you know, when I'm at the gym and my personal trainer is really pushing me and I'm you know, physically it feels like the hardest thing I've ever done. And you just think I've done something that's worse than this, you know, so, you know, you can get through it. I just think it can be really powerful, but it's not so easy to look at it like that when you're actually going through it. I understand.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. it's knowing that everything passes, doesn't it? We're all moving through, so even our challenges, everything's always changing, we're just moving through, kind of. We're constantly working at building our own resilience up.
Yeah, like even the therapists who practice, you know.
Even more succeeding, well, yeah, because we're using our minds as tools to help other people, so our minds have to be in a good place, and we're still getting challenged with the same stuff that's being thrown at us in life, and, you know, we have to be very self-aware, which makes it ridiculous that when you're training to be a CBT therapist, you don't have to have your own counselling, although most therapists, I think, do end up going down that route anyway, and getting that support.
So, for people at home that don't know too much about CBT, you know, you also do compassion-focused therapy as well, and EMDR. Like, tell people a little bit about that, the different styles and approaches that you use. And I guess this is more like the educational part, just so at least people have got a little bit to walk away with.
Yeah, so cognitive behavioural therapy is... kind of, it's about understanding patterns of our mind, so how our thoughts impact how we feel and what we do. So we are generally trained in the kind of therapeutic counselling approaches of empathy, non-judgmental awareness, and then you're trained in all the mood and anxiety disorders. So in CBT there's ongoing research all the time in certain areas like panic, OCD, depression, all the different anxieties, post-traumatic stress. So you're trained in all those different disorders and mental health problems. And when you're working with people, it's very much looking at the here and now. So you don't do, although generally therapists do train in other kind of areas and do look at past stuff, because sometimes it's our past that has really influenced where we are now. But generally within CBT, it's looking in the here and now, how your thoughts, feelings and behaviours are all interacting and developing unhelpful patterns, really helping, working with the client to kind of create awareness of those patterns. And with that awareness, then looking at strategies to kind of make the patterns of our minds more helpful for us, so we can kind of live more fulfilled and kind of happier life. And there's lots of kind of key strategies that have been found to be very useful, like thought records, like that, to help people kind of alter thinking patterns. There's lots of kind of doing behavioral experiments to challenge beliefs that we might have about certain things. And then, so does that kind of answer it, do you think? Have you got any questions for me?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, sometimes we do something all the time. It's really hard to think, what do I do?
Because I've done like rational emotive behaviour theory. Behaviour therapy. And I've covered off a little bit more of like CBT, like in my training. But that's almost the theory of it. I've had a go at applying it before. I actually did CBT on myself once and it worked.
Wow, very good. It's kind of strategy based, it's very problem solving, very goal focused. So in the first session I say, what do you want to get out of sessions? How do you want things to be in six sessions? And then really kind of pinning down what people want. The therapeutic relationship's very different in that I'm a lot more chatty and there's a lot more psychoeducation about how the brain works and things like that. So whereas in other forms of therapy, the therapist doesn't speak that much. Generally CBT therapists have to learn to be a lot quieter as we go on. So some people really want that. So people who kind of want strategies, I think the only downside is that some people have been kind of taught or feel that CBT is some kind of quick fix and they'll be given a strategy that will be a magic pill. And it does take quite a bit of work. It's kind of what you do in between sessions, like the journaling and that kind of building on sessions in between sessions. So it's very active therapy, really. And then So that's CBT.
Yeah.
And then I've been trained in EMDR, which that was the next thing I was trained in because of the research for post-traumatic stress. So EMDR is eye movement desensitization reprocessing. It was developed by a lady called Frances Shapiro. I think I said that right, in America. She'd been through a traumatic event. She was a psychologist and researcher, and she'd been through a really traumatic event. And while she was off, she would walk down, she would walk and look at the trees, kind of moving her eyes side to side, and found some benefits. So she researched it and only found that it worked. And so it's what it is, it's about kind of if you've been, say, in a car accident, people after a car accident, the way we our brain holds memories after a traumatic accident is that the memory can be quite disjointed or it can be quite frozen. So every time you recall the memory, it brings up a lot of emotion. It doesn't kind of settle down over time. You can have flashbacks, nightmares, intrusive symptoms, high levels of avoidance, disturbed sleep. And what we do is MDR is kind of sequence the trauma, so we'll really understand it from start to the end.
Yeah.
And then get people to remember the memory with an image, how it feels in their body, and then do some eye movements where you move your eyes side to side. And that sounds really odd and bonkers. And I was like, what the hell is this? When I was training, I was trained by a guy called Matthew Patterson, who's an OBE, and he was in the Troubles in Belfast years ago. He was in the army. And 3 weeks after he was married, his vehicle was blown up, his colleague was killed, and he lost both his arms. And as a result of that, trained as a psychologist, and now he's like an amazing, just such an interesting guy.
Gosh.
So he was teaching us, so, you know, he's practicing MDR for years. I was still there. This is completely bonkers, how does our movements work? But as part of the training, you have it done on yourself. So I'd seen a dog being knocked over, and that was something, you know, something that was very troubling. And it worked. So I did the eye movements, remembered the memory, did the eye movements, and your emotional intensity reduces. You recall different information, how it feels, just settles down. So you don't lose the memory, but when you go back to the memory, it's settled in your body. And the way they think this works, there's I think this is probably how, I'm not sure where they're up to the research, but is that when we sleep at night, we do something called rapid eye movement sleep, where you move your eyes side to side.
Yeah.
And at that time, you are processing information of the day and dreaming, so it's doing something with processing memory. And when you do that during the day with trauma memories, it processes the memory. And it is absolutely, after I trained, because I was one of the only ones in the mental health team that had been trained in it, that's all I did for ages, and the results are absolutely phenomenal. So I wouldn't use CBT, although I'm glad I'm trained in CBT as well, because it's good to have the kind of the knowledge. And I do, some people I work with trauma, they want to know that, you know, this is really normal. They want to understand what's happening in the brain, so it kind of normalizes it for them. But yes. Then we do EMDR really quickly to get the symptoms down. And I, you know, some people only need about 3 or 4 sessions, and it's called, which can sometimes be quite shocking for people. If, you know, I worked with somebody after the Lockerbie incident, so they carry trauma for 20 years. And then quite quickly you can change that for them. It can be quite a shock. But so that's been, and now the evidence is for trauma, but it's kind of possibly coming in. I've used it for unexplained medical conditions where people who don't express very well might have, say, a grief, but they're coming out in a rash or some neurological issue, and the kind of medics say it's psychological, and when you do the MDR, actually what's underneath is grief or some kind of pain. And I've used it for grief and started using it for some anxieties as well, really effectively. So that's EMDR. And then I've been trained in compassion-focused therapy, which was developed by Professor Paul Gilbert. He's OB as well, and he's over in Derby University. And he's a CBT therapist. He's also trained in lots of other therapies. So he's very, very clever. And he noticed that people who have CBT, not all of them get better. And his test is in, why do some people not get better with changing your thinking? And so what he asked one of his clients, well, you know, you kind of, instead of saying, I'm useless, you're saying, you know, I am of value. He said, how do you say that to yourself? And they would say it to themselves in a really hostile and critical way.
Yeah.
So you can change people, how people think, but if their tone is hostile and critical, they're not going to get better, because how your relationship with yourself is so, so important. So I would say about every client that I see, when I say to them, what's your relationship with yourself? Are you self-critical? Everybody says yes. And I know I've, since doing the compassion-focused therapy, I've done loads of work on my inner self-critic. And I think I've smashed it. And then now and again, I'll push myself out of my comfort zone. And then I'll find myself being really self-critical again. When we are self-critical and we don't support ourselves in the way we should, we support other people, we are, it's as bad as having a bully on your shoulder, walking around with a bully going, you're crap, you're rubbish, what's the point in doing that? It's horrific in terms of well-being, you know, you're setting yourself up for depression, anxiety, and reducing your resilience. So, and he's done quite a lot of neuropsychology, so you can help people understand how their brain works. And I found that people just go, wow, when I kind of do that work with people, because they're like, that makes sense. And it also kind of, you know, we are struggling. He's done a lot of evolutionary psychology, and Paul Gilbert would kind of say that we are all struggling with really tricky brains that kind of need a bit of an update for the world that we live in. You know, we've got a very high threat system, which is good for our survival, but things aren't out to kill us anymore. So it's about kind of training the brain to be more settled and soothed, and using self-compassion as a huge kind of way of doing that. And the, you know, that's a huge part of my practice. And each element, you know, it's just been so helpful.
Yeah, I can really see the sort of picture start to come together now with all, like, you know, CBT, EMDR, and CFT as well. Like, yeah. I can see how one, like, counsellor in a session would be able to pull from many different strands to give, like, quite a broad range of treatment options for a client coming in the room. Like, yeah, it's interesting. Like, I've learned a lot, and I knew a little bit about CBT coming into this interview because of my training, but I have to admit, I've never explored EMDR or CFT. My sort of training focused more on REBT, but equally fascinating everything that you shared. It's just really, really interesting, and I have to say, well explained as well.
Oh, thank you. And I think when you look at therapies, and I mean, I haven't, you know, I kind of know what I, but from the work when I was being trained by Paul Gilbert, he will say that when you go back, he's studied all the therapies, they're all strands of each other. It's really, we need to come together and think and look at each therapy model and think what's working and just do whatever's working. They're all kind of a little bit fragmented, and I think Paul has done a lot of work to pull together, like we do lots of chair work, which is hugely powerful. And I know that's done, I think that's Gestalt therapy that comes from.
I love Gestalt.
Yeah, so he's done a lot of work about pulling lots of the stuff together and going, let's just do what works, let's just see what works and do what works. So very grateful for all the researchers out there that are doing that work, so we can bring it into the clinic room. Well, you know, we're so individual, we need, that's how we're going to get better, is people taking a very individualized approach. And I think we need to kind of see ourselves as individuals and kind of really get to know ourselves. And I think the more responsibility we take for our own well-being and understanding our mind, the more we're going to know what's going to be right for us. We can access that kind of the most appropriate kind of support and care. But in therapy, it's a confusing world out there, isn't it? If you didn't know much about therapy and thought, oh, I'd like to have some therapy, what approach should I have? It's like a minefield. I don't know how anybody finds a therapist.
Yeah, because I know when I was looking for mine, I literally just went on counselling directory and picked a friendly face and that was it.
Yeah, I think that's quite brave.
Literally, that's what I did. I went scrolled down the list and I found one that was local to me and she had like a really friendly face and I was like, literally like dialed a number, left a voicemail and that was it. Because I was desperate. I was like, you know, I didn't have any options other than to go private.
Oh, God. And what was it like when you first met her? How did you feel?
Just felt like I could tell her absolutely anything.
And that's the key, isn't it? Sometimes it doesn't matter what the approach is. You've got to be with somebody that you think this. I believe this person can help me.
Yeah.
We've got, you know, and that we know that a therapeutic relationship is so important. That's so lovely.
Yeah, she's like, you know, I can't explain like, you know, how much respect I've got for her and. It's just like it's one of the most secure relationships I've ever had in my life.
Yeah.
Because you know, she challenges me and pushes me in like really, you know, appropriate and professional ways, but like it's also like compassionate and empathetic to the like the nth degree. And also just, you know, I don't know, it's just about she's just taught me from that relationship how every relationship should be.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I've just also, yeah, I knew that I could like, trust her and, I didn't believe her at first when she believed in me, but then I began to after that.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, it's hard. There's still stuff now that I've not, like, completely told her. Like, you know, literally, I think it was about 2 months ago, I went into therapy and I said to her, like, I explained, like, look, I think I'm ready to talk about some of the stuff that I have wanted to talk about since I started coming to therapy, but haven't had the courage to.
Yeah,
I said
it
like,
takes time, doesn't it, to build up that trust and know that they can hold you and hold your story.
Yeah. And I just said, like, I think the stuff that we're going to talk about is the reason, like, it's the root of everything.
Mm.
And she kind of just said, you know, she was like, I've been waiting for this for a while. And she said, she just said, I'm really proud of you for, like, you know, like
yeah.
coming to me, because she said I never, you know, planted any seeds or anything, it's all you. And she said
yeah.
you wouldn't have come to me with all this stuff if you hadn't been doing a lot of thinking. So
yeah,
so she's really encouraging, and you know, because of her, that's why I want to be a therapist, is because she's done such a good job with me and like instilled
oh,
the passion.
I hope she knows. Does she know?
Yeah, she knows, yeah.
Have you had her on the podcast?
No, I haven't, no.
Yes. I look forward to listening to her.
One day I will. It'll be emotional when it does happen.
Yeah, I bet.
Because, yeah, like, she's just, like, especially now I'm doing my training, she's like a real mentor to me. She's just been so supportive. As soon as I said that I wanted to be a therapist, she was just absolutely over the moon. She's been more supportive than anyone about it.
Oh wow, that's lovely.
So yeah, super happy and just really excited for what the future holds in that sort of
yeah.
respect.
Yeah, really exciting.
Yeah. What I was gonna ask is, I would say most people that I speak to, and probably some people who listen to the show as well, struggle with anxiety. I think you might agree as well, it's something that you probably hear about the most.
Yes, definitely, yeah.
So what are some tips and little bits of advice that you could perhaps give people to get them started on, either exploring their anxiety or just it could even be educational, just understanding it a little bit more?
I think the key thing with anxiety is that it's your internal alarm system. And I sometimes describe it a little bit like, you remember the old-fashioned smoke alarms when we used to have them in the house and they would go off randomly. We wouldn't all run out of the house screaming and calling the fire brigade. You'd go into the kitchen and go and get curious about it.
Yeah.
Our internal alarm system is called the amygdala. It's in our brain, which is the threat system, which is like your internal alarm system. Sometimes it goes off for no reason at all, and it's built to make you fight or flight. So it's the purpose of the threat system and anxiety is to make you do something to fight. But these days we don't physically fight, so we kind of go into our mind and we overthink, and we sometimes give the anxiety meaning, or we avoid and we block. When we do those two things, your threat system thinks, oh, I did a good job, I alerted you, you did a fight or flight, I'll do that again next time quicker. So you kind of strengthen the anxiety or threat system. And it's about kind of turning towards the feeling, recognizing that sometimes it goes off and it doesn't mean anything, and it's just really unpleasant. And it's about getting more curious about where it is in your body, how it feels, and kind of staying with it. The general thing with anxiety is that you need to kind of come to kind of a level of acceptance with it, and what you resist persists. So generally with anxiety, your efforts to get rid of it maintain it. So it's just like, I have a huge, I'm all right on podcasts, but I have a public fear, speaking phobia, or I have done, I'm kind of working my way through it at the moment.
I'd say you've done really well.
Yeah. Well, at the moment I'm just talking to a blank screen, so it's fine, but if you were to put me into an audience of 100 people or even 20, I'd my threat system, my anxiety would really come up, and I'd want to avoid it, or I'd kind of be overthinking it, I'd be very much in my own head. And it's really how I've worked towards that is keep nudging myself towards the fear. So it's about taking small steps, supporting yourself in a very compassionate way. So if you criticize yourself and go, I'm stupid, or I shouldn't be feeling this anxiety, everybody else is fine, you are triggering your threat system even more. So it's holding yourself, supporting yourself in a compassionate way, nudging yourself towards your fear, noticing where it is in your body, and really kind of breathing into that area. Sometimes when we just stay with anxiety and allow it and breathe into it, it settles down. So I think putting a mindfulness practice in place is really a great way. We've talked about the journaling as a way to create awareness. I think also mindfulness really helps you slow down and get used to the sensations that are in your body, and kind of relate to them in a different way, whether it's palpitations or hot sweats, or kind of trying to just be with them, not fighting and not avoiding them.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because I struggle a lot with meditation. I've tried it a few times to settle myself down, and I'd always find myself really fighting against it. So then I started doing mindfulness, walking around a lot more, or sitting at a cafe and watching the world go by, and just being in the moment, being comfortable with just thinking about the here and now. I found it found it so liberating. when I started going to the cinema on my own, because I could just sit there and just enjoy the moment. And I realised that it's one of the only places where once the film starts rolling, because you have to turn your phone off and all that sort of stuff, I would just fixate on something for a couple of hours, and I'd always come out, and I don't know whether it's because the lights are down and like you feel a bit more relaxed and at ease, but like I'd always come out just with a sense of relief and just like a sense of calm and well-being.
And we should be feeling that every single day. The interesting thing is that if you struggle with mindfulness, you need it just doing it with a busier mind, you know, and lifestyles are so busy. It's actually fashionable to be on the verge of burnout constantly. And it's a really scary culture to be in. We are not going to do well if we carry on with this culture. We have to be able to settle ourselves. So if you're struggling with anxiety, you need to look in your life and think, when are you giving your body time to settle? And I agree that sometimes that's mindfulness. I know if I'm really stressed or anxious, I have to do something a bit more active. Like I've got dogs, so I do a dog walk. There's no way I could do mindfulness. It'll do my head in. But yeah. I have a regular mindfulness practice that means that when I do get stressed, it's kind of, I've got those tools there that I can use, but you have to be sometimes more active. But generally, when we struggle with anxiety and look at people's lives, they've got no time where they're allowing the kind of nervous system to settle down.
Yeah.
At all. You know, working ridiculous hours, being just busy. And I think anxiety makes you feel restless and jittery and wanting to do. But you need to kind of, do the things that are soothing and feel quite irritated for a while. Like your threat system does not want you to go and have a bath because it's like you've got to be on guard for your survival. But when you do go and have that bath, it just brings your anxiety down, levels down a little bit. So it's being very holistic in your approach. I've just done put together a free guide on my website about building resilience. It talks about kind of the kind of foundations of well-being. I've tried to put together the kind of key things that I talk about in my first few sessions with clients that we all should be doing, you know, being more compassionate, journaling, having a mindfulness practice and things like that. So people can access that on my website if they want to have a look.
What's your address for your website?
It's sarahdreese.co.uk and Reese is spelled R-S.
Sorry, the signal went just a little bit there. Can you read that out again?
It's sarahdreese.co.uk and Reese is R-S-S.
Lovely.
And all my you can get to Twitter and Instagram on there as well.
Yeah. What are your handles for Twitter and Instagram?
For Instagram, it's sarahdreese.co.uk. And for Twitter, I'm not sure. I'll just go on to Twitter now and have a look.
Yeah, it's all right.
It's at sarahdreesecbt.
Lovely. That's great.
And I'm part of a lovely community on, I don't know if you're part of it, the hashtag 365 days of compassion.
No.
Have you not heard of that? Oh, it's lovely. People kind of sharing self-compassion tips and...
Is that on Instagram or Twitter?
It's on Twitter.
Okay, I'll jump on that now.
Yeah.
Let's have a look. 365 days of compassion.
Yeah.
Oh, I found it.
And it's kind of a mixture of people struggling with mental health problems and loads of professionals as well. It's really good resource. And there's a guy called Chris Winston who's if you kind of put a post with that hashtag, he'll collect all the moments together each day.
Oh, Chris Winston,
So he does that, yeah. Do you know him?
No, I know, I'm just looking though, and I know some of the people that he's tagged though, because I've done podcast episodes with him.
Oh, wow. So it's funny, isn't it, Twitter? You kind of realise that you're linked to people.
What a small world. Well, I'm now following Chris, so I'll check that out. That's amazing. Thank you for sharing that. And thanks for sharing all your links and stuff as well. I would implore you to check out, you know, Sarah's stuff, because, like, even this conversation so far has just been so useful. You know, I love everything that you've been talking about.
It's been a real pleasure. I've really enjoyed it. I hope it's not been too garbled. I could talk and talk and talk about this stuff. Obviously, I think we've gone over an hour, haven't we? But I've enjoyed it. Thank you. And yeah, if anybody wants to message me, I'm happy to, you know, answer questions and stuff. So you can contact me through my website or Twitter.
Lovely. Well, like I say, I want to say a really big thank you for coming on the show. It's the first time I've really had someone like talk about CBT as in depth as you have. And when I say you've done a really good job, I mean, you've done a super job explaining everything. You know, this isn't just like off the bookshelf sort of stuff. This is really complicated stuff, and all the years and experience that you've got, as well as your formal education, it just really means a lot that you come on and talk about all this with us.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate that. Thanks, Dan.
No worries. Well, that's been the episode for today. I hope you've really enjoyed it. I'd love to hear your feedback as well. If you've got any comments on stuff that we could improve on, or if you just really loved Sarah and want to throw some love her way, you know where you can reach her, or I can always pass on the love for you.
Thank you.
That's been the episode for today. I hope you've really enjoyed it. This has been Know Yourself with Dan Udell and Sarah Rees. Until next time, guys, peace out.